The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Robert J. Stegman presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Good afternoon, everyone. This is our case 4-23-1312, People of the State of Illinois versus Oswad J. Coates. I'd like counsel for the appellant, please state your name.
Gregory Peterson, Your Honor.
Okay, and Mr. Robinson, Mr. Crosby will do the arguing, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, welcome, Mr. Crosby. Happy to have you here, and I'm sure you will find it an interesting experience. So good for you. Okay, then, Mr. Peterson, without further ado, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Gregory Peterson. I work for the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent Oswad Coates, counsel. I stressed in my reply brief, Your Honors, that this was a pretextual stop. The reason I stress that is because this is a totality of the circumstances analysis. And when the totality of the circumstances here is considered, this is 5 minutes of insubstantial argument. This is a discussion. This is someone questioning the reason for it. And one of the things we know is that the police officer's reason for making the stop was, in fact, incorrect. That was a legal left turn, as this court has recognized in the past. So while the stop is permitted, Mr. Coates was driving in excess of the 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, I think it's completely reasonable for him to wonder why it is that he's being pulled over at this moment. We also see from the record that he, other than speeding, wasn't doing anything wrong. There wasn't contraband in the car. There were no weapons found. By the time they're searching through the trunk of their car, the officers are making jokes about be careful that you don't run into anyone's underwear in that pile of laundry. And the jokes matter too, because the state in its brief contends that this was an officer safety issue, that this police officer was in danger, and that he not only was in danger, but he felt that in the moment. He felt scared. The record simply does not reflect that. We have
a requirement, counsel.
I not an absolute requirement, Your Honor, but I think I would concede that if officer safety was actually implicated in here, that would be a material obstruction.
The U.S. Supreme Court made clear that the police officer in a traffic stop has absolute discretion in determining either one, occupants of the vehicle should stay in the vehicle, or two, occupants of the vehicle should get out.
I don't believe absolute discretion, no, Your Honor, but I do agree that there's substantial discretion given there.
No, that can the Supreme Court of the United States says the police officers can do that sometimes.
Yes, Your Honor. I think if it was for
and
explicit.
What's the criteria that the Supreme Court has used to explain when the police may direct someone to get out of the car?
I think it's when officer safety is actually implicated. I've had other cases, for instance, where the driver and the passenger have an order of protection against each other.
So traffic stops are dangerous things, and the police don't know who they're stopping. They are stopping a car, and there's someone in the car. And when you say for officer safety, how is a police officer supposed to know whether or not this is a dangerous person? And if, given the dangers with routine traffic stops and the lack of awareness of police on who they stop, what is the basis to conclude that the police erred in telling someone at a traffic stop, get out of the car?
Your Honor, I feel like there's two answers I'd like to give to that question. I'll start with the more direct one, which is that in this case, we have it from the officer himself that he wasn't threatened. We have him saying that Mr. Coates received the obstruction charge because he made the officer work. So in this case, the reason that I'm distrusting the argument that the officer was afraid for his physical well-being is because we have it straight from the officer.
So but, had he not said that, you wouldn't be here on appeal? Is that your position?
No, Your Honor, I think, frankly, Your Honor, I don't think a crime was committed here at all. But to the extent that officer safety could be implicated, if it is implicated in this case, it is implicated in every case. And anyone who is pulled over by a police officer is automatically obstructing and resisting from moment one.
Well, then that, unless they refuse to get out of the car.
Well, this is what would have been my second answer to your previous
Okay.
question, Your Honor. I don't think the command to tell him to step out of the car, I'm not arguing that that's unlawful. I'm arguing that 40 seconds of forceful but polite disagreement with that order, followed by Mr. Coates being physically dragged out of the car from behind, that's the bit that I'm focusing on. So I'm not saying that Officer Antoine did not have the authority or the discretion to give that order. I'm saying that 40 seconds later, Mr. Coates had not committed a crime by not
Does the
complying with
law
him.
require the police officer to wait before he can force the driver out of the car?
Yes, Your Honor.
How long was my question?
I don't
If
think there
40
is.
seconds isn't, if 40 seconds is too short, what's the criterion and what would be long enough?
It's a totality of the circumstances analysis, Your Honor. I do not think there is a set time limit either way, but I think we can both agree that if they had ordered Mr. Coates out of the car, grabbed him a millisecond later, and removed him from the car, that wouldn't have been obstruction. And I think we can agree that if they were still arguing on the side of the road by 8 a.m. the next day, that's obstruction. So I don't want to reject the applicability of the timing concerns here, but they're not the only concern here. These are fact-intensive analyses that should be considered for the totality of the circumstances. And I think.
Question to this extent, this is a question of fact on whether or not this delay was obstruction. Why isn't that something that we can look to the jury to resolve? Common experience in life and all the rest. They were instructed, after all, that the state has to prove beyond the reasonable doubt that the defendant knowingly resisted or obstructed the performance by the officer here, and they came back and said guilty. Why doesn't that, why should we reject the jury's determination that apparently the police in this, to the extent they had to wait at all before forcing him out, the police in this case waited long enough?
You should reject that, Your Honor, because the Illinois Supreme Court has told you must, has said that material impediment is an element of
Well,
this case.
okay, that goes to the second question, counsel, of, about the material impediment. But on the question of did they wait long enough, doesn't the jury's guilty verdict answer that?
No, Your Honor, not when the jury was not instructed on materiality.
By the way, since you brought that up, the Illinois Supreme Court directs trial judges to use IPI criminal instructions whenever they are on point. And there's an IPI number 2214 dealing with the charge of resisting or obstructing a peace officer. I'm sure you're familiar with it. The materially obstruct doesn't appear there. Is the IPI instruction wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. I think outside of even the context of this appeal, getting the pattern instruction changed to reflect the current state of the law is something my office is pursuing. After
So,
Kassler, it simply does not accurately set out everything that the jury must find.
we'd have to conclude that the IPI instruction was wrong and the trial court erred by giving the IPI instruction without modifying it. Is that correct?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think they're overlapping but distinct questions of was the jury given the correct instruction and did the jury know the elements that they were required to find in order to convict? And well, I think there's a closer argument as to that first question, but the second question, did the jury understand the elements of the offense? We can categorically say no. They were not instructed on this. So, Your Honor, Justice Steigman, you had asked, well, the jury found that he obstructed him. I think it's clear that he obstructed the officer in a de minimis way. Without the materiality aspect, everyone's obstructing it unless they comply at an instantaneous level. And even then, it would be within the officer's discretion whether your immediate compliance was immediate enough. But the whole point of that materiality requirement is to allow the finder of fact to make the determination about whether this was enough. I said that I believe the panel would be in full agreement with me that if this was a millisecond, Mr. Coates's convictions couldn't stand. I would concede that if this was 12 hours, I wouldn't be challenging them. But that is a fact question. I do believe no rational jury could have found materiality in this case, but I think it's also important that this jury was not instructed. But timing is not the only issue here in our fact analysis. It's also the character of the stop. This is why I discussed at great length people.
If counsel, if I may, before we sw have, looks like you might be switching gears there a little bit. I want to make sure we have time to talk about the Saturday or the Saturday case, because you have suggested in your brief that that case is dispositive, and I want to make sure that we work through a few points and questions I have with regards to that case. First, do you agree that the defendant in the Saturday case was actually charged under an earlier version of the statute?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so the statute now effective that we're dealing with here, as of January 1st of 2023, was amended to distinguish between the two different types of conduct giving rise to the offense of an act of resisting and obstructing, correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Now, under the Satter Bay case, the First District specifically based their analysis on whether the defendant's behavior constituted an act of resistance, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Does the fact that the court focused on resistance change the analysis such that that makes that case distinguishable from our case here?
No, Your Honor. And the reason here is that we are dealing, even in one edition of the statute books, we're dealing with three different statutory provisions. We're dealing with obstructing justice, obstructing a peace officer, and resisting a peace officer.
But
The
didn't the
only
First District note specifically that it stated critically? The state only charged the defendant with resisting, not obstructing. They seem to suggest that there would be a different analysis there.
Not on materiality, Your Honor. I think the Illinois Supreme Court has set out quite clearly that the materiality requirement runs across all three of these
Well,
statutes.
let's focus this as we evaluate the portion that involves whether or not he handed over his license. And whether that act alone would be sufficient to constitute obstruction and whether the evidence was sufficient. So focus the comments with regards to that issue, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what we have here is an indication that Mr. Coates would comply if given a sufficient explanation by the officer as to the cause of the stop. And you see the officer
But
and
he
Mr.
never says that, counsel. And he
Correct.
actually doesn't comply at any point. The officer actually has to take his license out of the wallet, doesn't he?
I believe they physically remove him from the car, and that essentially takes his ability to comply out of his own hands. But the state has filed a motion to cite People Against Sherman Willis. I think the comparison of the facts in Willis versus here, to some extent, illustrates what I'm saying. The officer in that case told Mr. Willis, "If you don't get out, I'm going to break this window." And Willis tells him, "Okay, break the window." We have that active indication of this is over, this is never going to work. Whereas if Mr. Coates's phrasings is always, "I don't have to do that until you tell me this, until you provide me with a sufficient explanation."
Didn't he also, though, continually discuss how he didn't find a traffic violation to be, quote unquote, against the law? So, I mean, at some point, it seems like the officer is going around in circles, if you will, with the defendant, and compliance did not seem to be anywhere near in the near future.
I have two answers to that. First of all, Your Honor, compliance does not seem to be coming in the near future is a is just a characteristically different situation than a statement that you will not comply, a statement that, okay, break my window. But second of all, to the extent that there has to be a line somewhere, that is a fact question that was taken from the jury in this case. So,
And you're suggesting it was taken because they weren't instructed with regards to materiality?
yes, Your Honor. And the whole point of materiality is that 3 days of argument is obviously obstruction. A millisecond of argument is obviously not instruction, is obviously not obstruction. So finding where to draw that line based on the circumstances of the case, again, my position is that it was simply not enough for any rational jury, but the jury here had that decision taken away from them. But I also, before Your Honor asked the question, I wasn't necessarily moving into issue two of the brief as much as making sure that I discussed the characteristics of this stop other than the length of what happens. People versus Meta is a case where officers are responding to a shots fired incident involving two people in a vehicle. When they stop a vehicle that matches the description, the driver takes off running and the second person won't turn around. That's heated. That's dangerous. That's the officer would absolutely be right in that situation to be nervous about his physical safety. People versus McAndrew, which I discussed in my reply brief and which played a part in the analysis in Willis, that's someone being arrested for presumptive DUI, slurring that she'd just been to see a star born and asking the cop, asking the officer, excuse me, if she can finish her bottle of vodka while she waits. That's a different situation than we have here. People versus Osman. That defendant's already been hit in the leg with a less than lethal bullet, and he drops to the ground and starts doing push-ups. There's an element of humor to these cases because of how dramatic they are, how heightened they are compared to this. This is a stop at its very worst for going 38 and a 30. Mr. Coates's fiance is sitting between him and the officer, taping the whole thing. The officer makes it clear, you made me work. Listen, I don't know you. You don't know me. I'm over here on the median because officers, or on the shoulder because officers can get hurt. This is a discussion. It's a discussion that involves both parties citing case law. And admittedly, the officer's case law was significantly better. It's a California appellate case that's a favorite of sovereign citizens against the United States Supreme Court. I'm, at least to that extent, I'm not saying the officer was wrong on the law, although I maintain, and I think this court agrees, that the officer was wrong on the law about that left turn. This is annoying at the very most. You can see the exasperation from the officer. Another thing I would point out is the moment at which the officer calls for backup and the manner in which he does it. It's when Mr. Coates says at about 2 minutes and 30 per timestamp, I'm a sovereign citizen, I have the right to travel. Officer Antoine immediately steps away from the car and goes, can I get some more people here, staff? He knows it's not going to be a completely routine interaction, but he doesn't make a move for his weapon. He doesn't indicate in any way that he's in danger. And again, we can know that he's not in danger because he says so himself. He says, you're catching this obstruction charge because you made me work. I think we can require officers to work. I think we can require something other than immediate and total submission. And this is a case where obstruction is the only charge. I
So
think.
let me ask just for a moment to distinguish a little bit, because we spent some time with the Satter Bay case. You know, that case is in the middle of the day. It's at 1 o'clock. It's two squad cars, multiple officers. This, as you've indicated, as I'll say approximately 9 or 10 o'clock at night, somewhere around there. They're pulled off on the side of the road. It's an officer by himself. And while I understand and I appreciate, and I guess I'll use the phrase that particular instance alone may not be fraught with danger, as the stop continues and the officer is not getting compliance, those matters do come into context to the stop. And at least at that point, the officer felt he needed to call for some, I'll say, assistance versus help. Not suggesting it's a fraught with danger, but I mean, at that point, the delay has now required the officer to seek assistance and pull officers from other areas to assist him. And that delay is caused by the defendant's failure to comply. Would you concede that?
No, as to the very last point, Your Honor, I would say he calls for assistance, I believe within 15 seconds of I see my time's expired, but I briefly finished the answer. Also, apparently there's a sound effect with that. He calls for the additional officers within the first minute, I believe within the first 20 seconds of talking to Mr. Coates. At that point, it's not about Mr. Coates's refusal to comply. It's about Mr. Coates's statement that he's a sovereign citizen, which, while annoying for the officer, is First Amendment protected. And I suppose the last thing I want to mention on that point is the case law out there about whether a missing element in jury instructions can be harmless. The Illinois Supreme Court in People versus Davis distinguishes between cases where the missing element transfers one crime into another, versus transfers something that isn't a crime into something that is. This is the latter scenario. If he doesn't materially obstruct the officer's authorized duties, Mr. Coates has done nothing wrong.
Hey,
It's
thank
perfect.
you, counsel. You have an opportunity to address this again in rebuttal.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Crosby, on behalf of the
Your
appellee, you may proceed, sir.
Honor. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case hinges on a question of fact. That should have been left to the jury. And that question was not taken away from the jury due to some sort of instructional error. And that's because the jury was properly instructed when it comes to this material impediment component of the statute. This court has previously held in People v. Wellis that here, when the jury's aware of the defendant's obstructive conduct, when there's been a detailed evidence and arguments at trial, there is no need to provide an additional instruction that deviates from the IPI instruction in order to inform the jury on this materiality component, which this court has described as an implicit component of the statute. I would add again that these terms here, materially impede, was reached by the Illinois Supreme Court by looking at the dictionary definition of the term of obstruct. And, in that case, we have a dictionary definition. This is a commonly understood definition. And as such, there would be no need to provide an additional instruction to inform the jury as to a definition of a term they're already expected to know. So for this reason, there really is no instructional error. I would add that the reason that we have this term material impediment goes back to People v. Comidge, People v. Cassler, and in these cases, we're not looking at the obstructing a peace officer statute. We're looking at the obstructing justice statute. And the reason review was granted in these cases is because the language of the statute is different. The obstructing justice statute enumerates a list of conduct that a person could do to obstruct without explicitly mentioning that those types of conduct must amount to an obstruction themselves. So that was the reason that we have this string of cases in obstructing justice. Statute cases, but that's really a whole separate issue from obstructing a peace officer here. It's very clear that there must be an obstruction because the statute explicitly states that it's a prescription on obstructing a peace officer. It's not about concealing evidence, it's not about lying to police officers. It's not about resisting arrest. It's very clear what's required here.
So you heard Mr. Peterson harping on the idea of the materiality and how the jury, in order to evaluate this conduct, according to language he cites, must be able to view this as a material impediment as opposed to just something minor. That's his primary argument. What is your response to that?
That the jury did view it as a material impediment, and that any jury would be expected to review it as a material impediment because that is what the definition of obstruction is. All obstruction. Now, some courts have referred to this as a de minimis exception. I think that can be it can be a little confusing when we're referring to like an element, a de minimis exception. But at the end of the day, the definition that was reached in Comage, material impediment, was the definition. It was not an impediment. A material impediment is an obstruction. The court says conduct that obstructs, that is conduct that materially impedes. It's not conduct that impedes. So really, the jury would be expected to know. That a material impediment is an obstruction in the first place. Now I would add that even somehow if this is an error, if the jury should have been instructed, if we want to look at the plain error analysis, again it's very clear that because of the safety threat, because of the knowledge that the jury has, this was clearly the right decision that any rational trier of fact would have reached. And I think here we have the defense counsel relying on People v. Satterbay heavily. But here we have these facts in this totality of circumstances analysis that clearly demonstrates this wasn't a close call. There was clearly a safety threat to officers. And I would direct the court to People v. Sinop, which is this very court has previously decided. We have the same sort of facts. A defendant stopped on the side of the road in the middle of the night. They're commanded to produce their ID and to exit their vehicle 4 times. They did ultimately comply. And a split second after they were grabbed on the arm, and the defendant again in Sinop was arguing with the officer about the law and why they were not required to comply with the police officer. We have the same set of facts here. We have even
Counsel,
more.
if I may, though, with Mena and a few other the cases that we have here, there does seem to me to be, if you will, two different frameworks somewhat that we evaluate these cases. One is those cases in which, the situation is really fraught with danger, inherently dangerous, where there is information, where they're looking for someone with a weapon, or where there are other indicators. And I appreciate that in this case, the officer made the statement, officers get shot, but as appellate counsel has pointed out, just because someone stopped for a traffic violation and there are no other indications that this situation was inherently dangerous, what other evidence really is in the record other than this was a traffic stop at night that would put us in that framework or those categories where officer safety is clearly threatened?
Well, Your Honor, I think as when we look at the totality of the circumstances, we have an officer stopped standing on the side of the road at night. We have the defendant who's identified themselves as a sovereign citizen, as someone who is not going to comply, someone who would cause the officer to call for backup out of fear that this defendant may resist the officer. When we're looking at all of these factors, the jury looked at these facts and made the conclusion that together these amount to a feared officer safety. I would add here in this case in trial, the defense counsel even acknowledged to the jury that the officers were in fear because they were, and I quote, afraid of what the people in the car might do. The defense counsel painted this as a case of a theme of fear, both fear by the defendant and fear of by the officers. So it was very, clear cut. Whether we're looking at the facts of similar cases, it wasn't really a question. It was an uncontested fact of the case that the officers were placed in fear during trial. So the jury would really almost have no choice but to conclude that the officers were placed in fear when as much was stated by defense counsel in trial.
So what about Mr. Peterson pointing out how the officer said at some point that he wasn't afraid, and also the other thing mentioned was that how his line that the officer said, "Gee, I was you just made me work." How should we view all that, and how could the trial trier of fact view it?
Well, I believe that defense counsel perhaps mischaracterized the statement, "You made me work." The officer did not say, "You're going to be charged with obstructing a peace officer because you made me work." Rather, the defendant questioned what he had done wrong. And it was in that context that the officer stated, "You made me work." But again, I don't think that anyone would take this literally. I don't think the jury would think that all that the defendant had done here was make the officer work. We have the defendant refused to produce his ID. He refused to exit the vehicle. He was arguing with the officer, and this wasn't a polite debate about the case law. And whether the California appellate court should be persuasive in Illinois, this wasn't a debate about the law. There was maybe a line or two, a sentence or two about this case law issue. But for the most part, it was, you can't tell me what to do. I'm a sovereign citizen. I'm not going to do what you asked me to do. So I think that right there, is a bit of a mischaracterization. And then, the officer, no matter what the officer is saying to the defendant, I believe here the officer perhaps was intending to cool down the situation in his interaction with the defendant. He wasn't going to tell the defendant, "I'm afraid for my safety. I'm calling for backup." No, he was trying to stall before backup could arrive. I think that was probably the conclusion that the jury would have reached in this case in arriving at its decision. But I think, when we're looking at the totality of the circumstances here, it was very clear that there was a threat for officer safety, and that would be the reason for that finding here. I think that it's really important to touch on the case of People v. Satterbay. I think that the First District has taken a different approach to the issue of placing an officer in fear for their safety and whether this would amount to an obstruction. And it's reached that conclusion based on People v. Sinnott, the case that this court has authored. In distinguishing between a significant impediment and a material impediment. And that's the reason we have some cases in which, if we were to apply the law correctly, it would seem that an outcome would be reached differently than the First District Court reached
So,
in particular.
counsel, just to make sure I'm clear, you're not suggesting that the case is merely distinguishable here. You're suggesting that it was wrongly decided.
That's correct, Your Honor. People v. Satterbay was wrongly decided for two reasons. The first of which is by distinguishing between a significant impediment and a material impediment. Satterbay cites this court's decision in Sinnott, and in order to reach this language, significant impediments, and differentiate it and say that it acknowledges that while the officer in Satterbay was placed, while his safety was put in jeopardy. This was merely a significant impediment. It wasn't a material impediment. But this court has stated in People v. Gotchel, again, that People v. Sinnott found there to be a material impediment, although it uses only the language significant impediment. The Illinois Supreme Court has also found or stated that Satterbee found there to be a material impediment in People v. Baskerville. So really, there is no difference here between a significant impediment and a material impediment. In fact, this very court, just a couple of weeks ago in People v. Willis, uses the language significant impediments and material impediment interchangeably in its opinion. So for this reason, it was simply wrong as a matter of law to draw this distinction in People v. Satterbee. Now, additionally, Satterbee also relies on this distinction about physical resistance or physical obstruction, that the defendant would have to physically exert himself in order to create an obstruction. And again, the Illinois Supreme Court has stated that that is not the case. In fact, this mistake right here also explains why a number of cases that deal with obstructing justice were decided incorrectly following this Illinois Supreme Court decision. So really, I think for both of those reasons, there's really not a good reason to rely on People v. Satterbee in over this court's own decision in People v. Sinnott and People v. Willis. I'd also like to touch on the issue of whether this jury instruction error was preserved by the defense counsel's supposed ineffective assistance of counsel. I think that there's really no way that this issue was preserved because, first of all, the deficiency prong here cannot be met. The defense counsel has argued that, because the defense counsel did not object to the IPI instruction or offer an alternative instruction or raise the issue in a motion, that this was ineffective assistance of counsel. But here, the jury never requested any clarification. The jury never asked any question about what the term obstruct means. Here, and in any way, in any event, it would not make sense to provide an instruction when we're asking for the definition of a commonly understood term, to provide a dictionary definition of a commonly understood term. That would simply be superfluous. I mean, there's really no need to request an unnecessary jury instruction. But that's not the kind of conduct that's deficient performance. It would actually be inefficient performance to ask for this needless instruction. But additionally, we don't have any prejudice here. We can't really expect the jury to have reached a different outcome had they been instructed on a commonly understood word using a dictionary definition. And really, that is what the defense counsel is proposing when we're discussing changes to the IPI instruction. This is, a material impediment. It's really just not a necessary instruction here. We already know what that means. We expect the jury to know what that means, Your Honors. So really, for these reasons, we ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Peterson, on behalf of the appellant, you may make your rebuttal argument at this time, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few of my responses to the argument the state just advanced, I think, are adequately set out in my briefs, including the theme of fear there. Defense counsel wasn't arguing that the police officers were fearful. Frankly, I believe what defense counsel was doing was going for jury nullification. Counsel thought that de minimis obstruction was enough, and so argued that Mr. Coates's fear made him incapable of knowingly resisted. Effective counsel would have fought that on the element that was there, the element of a material impediment. Relatedly, I think the state is essentially reading Kassler out of existence. if material impediment is included in the standard definition of obstruction, then there was no reason that the Illinois Supreme Court needed to grant review in that case in the first place. It's there, and this IPI instruction is outdated. But Justice Leonard, your question about Saturday, I'd like to give you a more comprehensive answer to that. And I'd like to point you to paragraph 39 of Saturday. That's talking about the difference between obstruction and resistance. And it says, and I'm quoting here, acts that obstruct may be different from those that resist, but the line by which they become criminal is drawn in the same place. That case then goes on to talk about the physical actions that Mr. Satterbay did while saying that the physical component can include inaction. And that's what we're dealing with here as well. Mr. Coates does not, unlike, for instance, Mr. Willis or any of the other cases we've discussed, his what Mr. Coates is doing physically is he's not doing things. But I agree, if those are a material impediment to the officer's duties, then they're enough to be obstructive. My whole point here is that they're not, and that decision was taken away from the jury. I'd also point out that the state says that what the officer was doing when he was engaging Mr. Coates in this conversation was that he was stalling as he waited for other officers to get there. Your Honors will be well familiar that this is not part of an officer's authorized duties. If you don't have the backup there, then you don't have the backup there yet. But I understand that the reason this discussion was occurring was because Mr. Coates wanted a proper explanation for what had happened. He wanted to know why, when he was driving 37 in a 30, the moment he crossed into the town's limits, a squad car started following him. He wanted to know when he and his head, all he had been doing was driving home at a maximum of 37 and 30. Why it was this time that he gets pulled over? Why, when he makes a legal left turn, he gets pulled over? But
Counsel, we talked about you emphasized the remarks of the police officer as we evaluate that testimony. What about the statement of the defendant telling the officer that he was a sovereign citizen and what all that might mean to the officer? To what extent does that help to inform the officer's judgment that he's going to need backup and that he's not likely to get cooperation by just having a respectful explanation and dialogue with the defendant as he sat in this in his car?
I don't think it's by any means dispositive, Your Honor, and the reason is because that's having fringe political beliefs is First Amendment protected. I do believe that the moment
Talking
Mr.
about political beliefs, counsel, where we're talking about behavior associated with that belief, such as a reluctance, if not a refusal, to accept police authority in a situation like this. Why wouldn't your client's volunteering to the officer that he was a sovereign citizen put the officer on notice that he has no reason to believe that respectful discussion is going to lead to any resolution of this situation where the defendant will voluntarily comply with the officer's direction to get out of the car?
Frankly, Your Honor, because of my own life experience, I represent sovereign citizens. I do
Well,
give them.
counsel, that's interesting, but I want to know, we don't have your experience advising the officer. I want to know to what extent should we infer from your client's volunteering this information to the officer that this makes the officer's judgment that much more appropriate that this guy's never going to comply with what I have to say, as opposed to a situation where he hadn't volunteered that? What about that?
Recognizing that my time has expired, Your
Please
Honor, I'd
answer the
briefly
question. Go
answer
ahead
that.
and take your time to answer.
The officer's judgment from that moment is not that compliance will never occur. It's that compliance may require more discussion to get to, that it's not going to
We
be
know
automatic.
that. What is there in this record that suggests the officer doesn't believe compliance will never occur?
The fact that the officer keeps argue, keeps offering case law and keeps there's a moment
Well, that's
during.
while waiting for the other's backup once he was told the sovereign citizen. That's what he's doing. But as soon as the other officers get there, what basis does this officer have to believe this discussion will ever bear fruit that your client will get out of the car voluntarily?
He sees from the discussion they're having that the discussion is moving, albeit slowly, Your Honor. He, after about the fifth time that Mr. Coates cites People versus Battle, the officer asks him, okay, what is that? What's the holding in that case? He's willing to engage with him. I think there's indication of that. I do want to just briefly, because the state says I'm misrepresenting the record, I'd
Go
like to
ahead.
finish with, the timestamp is 2740 through 2802 of Officer Antoine's squad camera. The direct quote is, "There's no hard feelings, ma'am, but here's where I'm at." And then I skipped a little. "I'm not going to give you any tickets for speeding or the lane violation or any of that. You're going to get one citation for not having a license. And then you're going to get into obstructing because you made me work." That's the officer's own words. That's the officer's explanation of what happened. Mr. Coates's expression of his admittedly fringe, admittedly incorrect theories about the law annoyed this officer enough that the officer decided to arrest him for obstruction. Castler requires more.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Aaron.
The court will take this matter under advisement in due course, issue a written decision, and at this time, we'll stand in recess.